Inside the Universe of The Expanse, with its authors, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Forgive this fanboy's excitement. As this episode of our show is published, we're just 2 days away from the Season 4 premiere of a wonderful show that was almost lost forever. And we're also not far from release of the last book in the series of novels that the TV drama is based on. The Expanse is one of the best hard science fiction sagas I've ever enjoyed. Its authors and producers will join me in minutes. We'll start with a few real-world developments brought to us by Planetary Society editorial director Jason Davis. These and other stories are in his weekly digest we call The Downlink. The European Space Agency's CHEOPS spacecraft may be in space by the time you hear this. Of course, it's an acronym. The Characterizing Exoplanet Satellite will study nearby stars to determine the density of planets that are already known to be circling them, another step toward discovering if there are exoplanets that are suited for life. Speaking of exoplanets, it's possible that the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to tell us if some rocky worlds have atmospheres. A team of scientists has proposed a new and much faster technique for detecting atmospheres. Now we just have to get JWST up there and working. That's expected in 2021. Both a SpaceX Dragon cargo ship and a Russian Progress have docked with the International Space Station. Together, they have delivered about 5 metric tons of cargo, including experiments like the barley germination project we talked about a couple of episodes ago. And Japan's Hayabusa 2 has turned its ion engines back on. They will speed those precious samples of asteroid Ryugu back to Earth in about a year. There's more waiting for you at planetary.org/downlink. Jason publishes a new edition every Friday. Many of you will remember my visit to Santa Fe, New Mexico to attend last spring's Interplanetary Festival. I've saved a highlight of that visit till now, as The Expanse is about to return to our TV screens. The story starts in our own solar system. Humankind has spread beyond Uranus and is divided into 3 major factions. Plots generally revolve around the crew of the Rocinante, a fighting ship that has been, shall we say, liberated from the powerful military forces based on Mars. Rocinante was Don Quixote's horse. It's a great name for a spaceship that is captained by the decidedly quixotic James Holden. All of the characters are terrific. The action is jaw-dropping. The planetary politics have much to say about our own times. And thankfully, the science is realistic and impressive, even when it eventually moves out across the Milky Way. For these elements and more, we can thank Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. They write the series novels and short stories under the pen name James S.A. Corey. And they are also producers of the TV show, which after being canceled by Sci-Fi, has moved to Amazon Prime. Daniel and Ty and a bunch of their enthusiastic fans joined me last June under an Interplanetary Festival tent.
You guys have a lot of fans here today, and I'm one of them. It is an absolute honor to have you here. I told you just before we got started that it was listeners who, I think you already had about 4 books out, first said to me, what, you were not reading The Expanse? You have got to get started with this. I was only a few pages into Leviathan Wakes when I was completely hooked. So thank you.
Well, no, thank you. I'm glad it's working for you.
Yeah, it sure is. I read that the two of you met not too far from here in Albuquerque.
That is true. For those of you who are not present and would just like to know who's talking, I'm Daniel. So when you hear this voice, that's me. I was born in Albuquerque. I've been in Albuquerque pretty much my whole life. So it wasn't a big commute for me. Ty moved to Albuquerque, and we had some friends in common, and Ty wound up in the same writing group that I was in, the critique group that I was going to every month. we wound up being kind of the two people who lived close enough to each other, and he introduced me to console gaming and was trying to bring me over and get me to play Left 4 Dead and generally reduce my productivity, and it didn't work out so well. So,
Ty, you had started to create the Expanse universe with something else in mind. You weren't originally thinking of a series of best-selling science fiction novels.
No, there's been a lot of versions of The Expanse. I mean, initially it was a video game pitch a long time ago, and then a tabletop game, and then eventually the books. So it's been through a lot of iterations, and now a TV show, and I'm waiting for the stage musical.
I think it's ripe for conversion to a musical, absolutely. Since the story is frequently told from the viewpoint, chapter by chapter, of different characters, you hand it off, don't you?
We started out that way, but that eventually sort of went away. When we first started, we picked which viewpoint character we would write, but I think by about book five, we weren't doing that anymore.
Yeah, it got to the point where we kind of knew each other's voices. After long enough, you wind up kind of losing the confusion. You've done it long enough, you've practiced it. So I could imitate Ty's voice, Ty could imitate mine, and we're both editing each other's work the whole way through anyway, so there's always that error correction phase.
We divide it up more now by content, so if the chapter is about somebody being sad, Daniel writes that.
Yeah, pretty much.
If the chapter has a lot of explosions in it, I write that.
Yeah. It's pretty much kind of a violence and romantic failure division of labor. That's how we do that.
Seems to work.
So far. I mean, we have one more book in the project, so we'll see whether we stick the landing.
Once you finish the first book, Leviathan Wakes, did you have any idea it would take off the way it did?
No.
We wanted to have a series title, so we made up a series title by going, well, what's a synonym for big? it was really us marketing the book to publishers that was the thing that turned it from a standalone novel into a series.
But it has become, I think it is right up there with any of the great science fiction sagas throughout history. Foundation Trilogy, you name it.
Well, I think we should check in on that in about 50 years.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then I'll give you that, but
we'll,
I bet you're
we'll
going to do
goes.
Okay. Listen, I was on the freeway like a week ago, and I do a double take because the car in front of me, I see, has an MCRN, Mars Congressional Republic Navy sticker on it. I have the original member of the MCRN here on my tie. So it's Marvin the Martian. Obviously, it is, maybe it won't be in a half a century, but it is a cultural phenomenon right now.
Well, we're hoping so.
It's doing okay.
It has certainly been a weird ride for us. We were aiming for something that was fun to do and would make pizza money. This has overshot that. We're doing something else now.
I could rave for hours about the entire series and what you create and how you open up the galaxy to humanity. But it's really, for our purposes on Planetary Radio, it's the early books that probably are more relevant. And we'll give less away, although we may still have a few spoilers, warnings to anybody who has not been through the books already. It is this future of our solar neighborhood that you drop us into at the very beginning of Leviathan Wakes. It's already all in place that I think is really going to be relevant for our Planetary Radio audience. I wonder how much of that system-wide civilization and economy that you've designed, a lot of it is made a lot easier because of one technological development. You know the one I'm thinking of, right? The Epstein Drive.
Yeah.
Or is it Epstein?
I don't know. He's dead. We don't get to ask him.
That allows everybody to get places a lot faster than they would with propulsion technology we know about now. Do you think that that kind of universe, that kind of solar system that you created, would it have been practical without this way? And we should say, it's not like warp drive. It's just a really efficient way of creating a rocket to get people from here to there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a fusion reactor with a little afterburner on it. No, I mean, I think the reality is that while we will certainly send more stuff out into the solar system, and, you know, they're talking about a permanent base on the moon, which is great, talking about manned exploration of Mars, which is really cool. The economic argument for massive expansion into the solar system is a difficult one to make right now, especially when you can use robots to do things. It feels unlikely for that reason, but you know, as we've often said, we don't find robots interesting to write about, so we didn't do that version of the future. But yeah. I mean, if you're looking at where we are now and the likelihood of the future, that seems much more likely, is it? If we want to mine something off of an asteroid, we send robots out to do it.
That's Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham, creators of The Expanse. They'll have more to tell us after the break. This is Planetary Radio.
I know you're a fan of space because you're listening to Planetary Radio right now. But if you want to take that extra step, to be not just a fan, but an advocate, I hope you'll join me, Casey Dreyer, the chief advocate here at the Planetary Society, at our annual Day of Action this February 9th and 10th in Washington, D.C. That's when members from across the country come to D.C. and meet with members of Congress face-to-face and advocate for space. To learn more, go to planetary.org/dayofaction.
Hi, I'm Jason Davis, editorial director for the Planetary Society. Did you know there are more than 20 planetary science missions exploring our solar system? That means a lot of news happens in any given week. Here's how to keep up with it all. The Downlink is our new roundup of planetary exploration headlines. It connects you to the details when you want to dive deeper. From Mercury to interstellar space, we'll catch you up on what you might have missed. That's the Downlink, every Friday at planetary.org.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. The fourth season of The Expanse has come to Amazon Prime, and the ninth and final novel is not far off. That's what we've heard from the creators of this franchise, Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. They write the novels as James S.A. Corey. As you may have guessed, much more of my conversation with them at the Santa Fe Institute's Interplanetary Festival is available online at planetary.org/radio or any podcast provider.
In your solar system, in your universe, there are three major factions. You got Earth, you got Mars, and you have those fascinating folks, the Belters, who really occupy more than just the big asteroids in the belt, right?
Yeah, no, the Belters.
It's anything beyond Mars, really.
Yeah. The Belters, I guess at least their ancestors, they went out there to get away from.
Well, or they went out there to make money. Or, yeah. I mean, I don't think it was that first wave of migration was built on the idea of making an independent, autonomous space so much as finding ways to get lots of money for getting platinum. So much of human migration is driven by those kind of immediate family-sized monetary and economic issues. How it's been through a lot of history, and it's how we imagined it going forward.
So not so much pilgrims trying to avoid oppression and set up their own oppressive society, but the profit motive.
Yeah.
Well,
almost everything that happens, happens because somebody thinks they can make money off of it.
And yet, these Belters, they get a pretty raw deal overall.
Well, many people are wrong.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty clear line from them to our modern Earth. You know, the people in the DRC who dig up coltan, which is an incredibly valuable mineral, they're not rich. The people who dig the coltan up don't ever get rich from that. So the idea that just because you're the person who does the manual labor that extracts the valuable resource, that's often not connected to who actually makes money on that resource. And so we were sort of riffing on that, that the people who went out and dug these things up in this incredibly dangerous environment in space, they're not the ones who get rich off of it. Somebody back on Earth, later in Mars,
has found a way to leverage that.
Yeah, they're the ones who get rich off of it. And that just feels very real.
They get their revenge, of course.
Well, again, we read a lot of history. and one of the things you see a lot through history is this cycle of oppression and kind of institutionalized cruelty then playing out over generations. It becomes a cultural fact. It becomes a thing that is passed down from generation to generation. It fuels future conflicts. And as long as you have those wounds that aren't healed, they keep flaring back up.
Yeah. The more I learned about the Belters and their society, the more I thought of the great Marshall McLuhan quote, "First we shape our tools, and then our tools shape us," which I guess would apply to the worlds we live on or inside of as well. Are you ever sorry that on the TV series, they can't physically represent belters the way you guys, they really have become almost, not a different species, but they're very different even physically from the way we are here on Earth.
Yeah. On the other hand, we have a long history of finding other physical traits to be prejudiced about. So it's nice that we have one, especially for the books, where we can talk about that kind of prejudice and racism without actually co-opting anybody's lived experience here.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been interesting if we could do that visually, but I feel like we did a pretty good job making it a separate culture.
Yeah, there's also an argument to be made that if the belters were very visibly different from everybody else in the way, same way they are in the books, that the average viewer who hasn't read the books just sees them as an alien race, which sort of messes up the whole point of the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the whole point, and somebody earlier was asking, you know, which faction do we side with? And, you know, sort of the thesis of the series is that factionalism is the problem, that picking sides is the problem, that tribalism is the problem. And so if you give a viewer a way to easily identify tribes, in some ways that sort of takes away from the message that you're trying to send.
There is one scene, at least only one that I know of in the TV series, where you do see a belter who looks the way you described. It's got to be CGI. It's a guy who's like in a dungeon.
Hung on hooks.
Do you know
that?
Yeah.
There are other tall belters.
Yeah, there's a scene in a bar early on in the first season where a very tall guy walks by.
The one guy at the Zocalo who was giving stuff to Miller and Simatimba he was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, so we do try to find these very tall, thin people that we cast, and the idea being that they're the extreme version of that, the ones who grew up in very low gravity environments, but that sort of extreme physiology.
Ignoring the physical changes that have taken place, I think the TV series does a pretty good job of capturing how culturally different belters have become, where they've developed basically their own language or patois or what, dialect. It's fascinating. And the way that they use their hands to communicate, because they're so used to being in pressure suits, all of which you guys created.
Well, all of which we stole from other places. I mean, let's be fair about that. The hand gestures are speculating up off of scuba diving now.
Yep.
You know, Ty was talking about the belter creole being our version of Greek fisherman's language, where you have people who are from a bunch of different countries with a bunch of different languages all working the same waters and doing the same job. Yeah, you find ways to communicate, and that becomes its own thing.
Yeah, you take the word from each language that best describes a thing, and that becomes a new language. It's just all the best words.
Yeah.
If you assume that every country on Earth sent people out into space, that's hundreds of languages. Those people all have to find a way to talk to each other. And that you wind up sort of a new thing.
The version we have in the books is what you might call not rigorous. it was built to have an effect and to create an experience for the reader. It wasn't built to accurately represent linguistic drift. For the show, it's much more rigorous and accurate.
Was somebody brought in?
We hired a linguist.
Wow.
To create a language.
We are not linguists. And that is not something we do.
Well, we should add, you guys are both producers on the show, right?
Yes.
We are, yes.
We are more involved in the show than any other writer I know has been involved with anything they have had adapted from them. It's weird. We are in a very strange space.
I have to mention one other almost little throwaway short scene. It can't last more than 3 seconds. It is in the television series. I think it says something about the accuracy that all of you have gone for in the TV series. And it's where somebody is pouring a drink and they're on one of the asteroids that the belters live in. You can see as the liquid is poured, it goes a little bit to the side. Coriolis effect.
Because yeah. It's a fence station.
Damn, that's good.
Now, it's very exaggerated.
So you can see
so
it.
So you can actually see it. Because it would be, in reality, it would be much less exaggerated than that. But that curve would be there. But we wanted to make sure it was visible to the viewer, yeah.
We try to go for a universe in which, like, inertia works and gravity works. And it turns out that's enough to make people think you're hard science fiction as opposed to kind of squishy soft, a little kind of, you get a lot of credit for that.
But that's one of the great things about the books and the TV series, I think. Because I know that the two of you also collaborated on a Star Wars novel.
We did. That was less rigorous. That was there was actually funny thing. The climax of that Star Wars novel had some things going on that were ridiculous. There was a point where we were getting ready to kind of choreograph the final battle, and Ty was going, "This is not possible." I said, "It's Star Wars." That's fine.
Which is why I think of it as a fantasy series rather than a science fiction series.
Which is perfectly legitimate. Nothing wrong with that.
But The Expanse is science fiction. It's good science fiction.
Well,
good
I like
science,
it, yeah.
I think.
Well, it's okay.
Yeah.
Everybody here has a much higher opinion of your work, I think. No, don't you guys?
Yeah.
I am a true fan. I cannot wait for the last book or the fourth season. I bet everybody here feels the same way. Please join me in thanking Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank, the creators of The Expanse.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. He is back to talk to us about what's up in the night sky, and I hope to help us celebrate a little bit something that we knew was coming, but we couldn't talk about. When I talked to Bill Nye a couple of weeks ago about LightSail 2, we've gotten another award.
We did indeed. Popular Science has chosen LightSail 2 as its grand award winner in aerospace for the top innovations in 2019, and we beat out some pretty big competitions, so we're quite proud of that.
Quite an accomplishment, and we thank Popular Science. And thank you to you and the rest of the team for once again proving that we were on to something great with this.
Yeah, worked out well, and we're still flying and still tweaking issues and still figuring out how to solar sail more efficiently as we slowly drop closer due to atmospheric drag.
Well, we don't want to go there just yet. But
no, no.
let's go on up to the night sky.
In the night sky in the evening, Venus getting higher, super bright, brightest star-like object out there in the west in the early evening. Below that now, just below it is Saturn looking yellowish, and it will continue dropping, so check it out. In the pre-dawn sky, you got Mars over in the east looking reddish into its upper right, Spica, the bluish star of Virgo. On to this week in space history. It was 1972 that Apollo 17 successfully landed and left the moon, the final humans to visit the moon, 1972. On to random space fact. Just didn't have the energy in it today. Sorry. we're going to start with some definitions and move to something quite interesting. It's the old solar day versus sidereal day. A solar day is how long it takes an object to have the sun come back up to the same point in the sky. So like one noon to another noon, it's 24 hours on Earth. A sidereal day is how long it takes the object to rotate relative to the fixed stars. So not counting the orbit around the sun. And so for Earth, that's 23 hours and 56 minutes and 4.1 seconds. Okay, that's interesting, but they're really close. But you get really weird when you talk like about some other planets, say Venus. It takes 243 days to rotate on a sidereal day, rotate on its axis relative to the fixed stars. Takes only 117 days to do a solar day for the sun to come back to the same point in the sky. Of course, there is a catch with Venus, that if you were on the surface and survived and didn't melt, you couldn't see the sun anyway, so I don't know what the point of this whole exercise was.
Well, I don't know. It may matter to the Venusians.
All right. We move on to the trivia contest. I asked you, what is the largest known object in our solar system that has not been visited by spacecraft, with notes, flybys count as visits, and we are not counting the sun? How'd we do, Matt?
We had a minority of respondents who thought it was Pallas, that asteroid in the belt, right? It's a
Pallas is much smaller, and it is next in line. Since we've done Ceres and Vesta, it's next in line for an asteroid, but the asteroids are much smaller than those things way out in the outer solar system, at least the largest of them. So
here's the one I think you wanted. And I'm going to read this from a friend of the Planetary Society, friend of Planetary Radio, one of our volunteers who's a regular listener and entrant in the contest, Ocean McIntyre, here in SoCal, Southern California.
Excellent.
Eris is the largest named object in the solar system that has not been visited. And then she put in parentheses, unless you mean Planet 9, but since it hasn't been physically seen, shrug, she writes out.
Yeah, I wouldn't count it as known, but it is maybe there. We're hoping.
She's right, but our winner is Royal Snodderly. Royal Snodderly up in Ketchikan, Alaska. It has been almost 2 years since Royal's last win. He agreed that Eris is that largest known object in our solar system that has not yet been visited by a spacecraft. I guess there aren't any in any other solar systems that have been visited, so not by us anyway.
No, not by us anyway.
Royal, we're going to send you a Planetary Radio t-shirt that you can check out in the Planetary Society store at ChopShopStore.com. I like it a lot. I wear it. We're ready for another one.
Happy Planetary Society anniversary, Matt.
Yay.
We're 40 years old as of November 30th. The Articles of Incorporation were filed in 1979. So for a 40-year-old Planetary Society, exactly 40 Earth years old, how old is the Planetary Society in Mercurian years? What anniversary approximately would we be celebrating in Mercurian years? Assume the Planetary Society to be 40 Earth years exactly. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 18th, that would be December 18, 2019, at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer and win yourself, okay, a Planetary Radio t-shirt at chopshopstore.com. But wait, there's more. You know why? Because Bruce Betts has written a new book, and I'm looking at it right now in Amazon. We'll put up the link to it here in Amazon or someplace. It's the VR or Virtual Reality Space Explorers, subtitle Titan's Black Cat. And it's cute. I like it. It looks like the first of maybe a series.
Well, here's hoping. Here's hoping. It's a fictional group of kids in the future who take virtual reality tours with their hologram and robotic dog to fun places in the solar system.
That'll be yours too, that and the shirt, if you're chosen by random.org as this new contest winner.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what type of noise they could use for backup sounds on trucks that would be more amusing than just beeping. Thank you, and good night.
Get Back by the Beatles.
Nice.
That's Bruce Betts. He is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its expansive members. Join us at planetary.org/membership. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Ad Expanse.